As part of their enduring commitment to justice, equity, and expression, the Open Society Foundations are proud to sponsor Many Lumens. You're listening to Many Lumens, where we talk about and find meaning in the intersections of art, social change, and popular culture. I'm your host, Mayori Carmel Holmes. In this episode, I had the pleasure of speaking with chefs Omar Tate and Sybil St. Aude Tate, who are the founders of the African diaspora-inspired grocery store and cafe, Honeysuckle Provisions, in West Philadelphia. Omar is a Philadelphia native who has worked in acclaimed kitchens throughout the Northeast, where he witnessed firsthand the gaps in representation in the culinary world and decided to devote his career to showcasing the legacy and diversity of Black food. Sybil is a talented chef who has appeared at the acclaimed James Beard House in New York City, on Food Network's Chopped, and at the Charleston Food and Wine Festival. Raised on Long Island by Haitian parents, her heritage is a cornerstone of her cooking, as she sees food as a window into the culture and history of her people. Omar and Sybil joined me in person here at the Black Star Project's office. And now for my conversation with Omar Tate and Sybil St. Aude Tate. Thank you for agreeing to do Many Lumens. Welcome to the show. I want to talk a little bit about your earlier life. And before we started recording, Omar, you were talking about being from the neighborhood that our office is in South Philly. And I know that your family also has deep roots here, but also roots in Germantown. And I was curious, what kind of food or like even like cultural dishes represent these neighborhoods to you?
Well, you know, oddly enough, one of the first smells that I remember is not like soul food or anything around here. There's a huge Southeast Asian population, but to me, in my head, that was the epicenter of like something that wasn't mine. Mm-hmm. You know, because we never had the food that I was smelling when I was a kid. At home, there's rice, there's greens, there's fried fish was a big deal. Grits is like the big thing that comes to mind when I think about South Philly, because again, we moved to North in Germantown when I was quite young. But when I think about these neighborhoods, I think I mostly think about Southeast Asian food and then the intermingling of cultures and relationships. And now, you know, there's Mexican food like that's very present mm-hmm. in this neighborhood. So, you know, but then moving to Germantown in North Philly, this is also kind of coinciding with when my mom became Muslim. You know, pork's gone. Yeah. You know, it disappears. I was eating pork when I was a baby, mm-hmm. And all the way up until like 4 years old. But that's gone, and that's when like the blanket of blackness in food kind of like becomes I never saw white people like ever. Seriously, like in North Philly and Germantown where I grew up, mm-hmm. if you saw a white person in the neighborhood, they were there for a fucking reason. Like there was a cop. They were coming to deliver stuff. So like no more Italian deli smell, mm-hmm. you know, no more of the Southeast Asian food, mm-hmm. no more Italian food. I don't smell that anymore. All I smell is like, I smell greens. I smell fish. I smell chicken. But then also the backdrop of all that, right? Because there's the mingling of these smells. There's like frankincense and myrrh and incense and all this stuff. It's like a friggin' Badu video all the time. So it's hard to not like recall all those other smells along with the food, because that's the nostalgia piece. Like mm-hmm. that's the comfort. The food alone doesn't satisfy that thought to me.
Yeah. Sybil, I read that you're the youngest of four siblings and you were the first to be born in the States, and that your parents immigrated from Haiti and settled in Long Island. And I was curious, what sort of food and tradition did they bring over? And like, how did that intermix with what you were witnessing in Long Island?
When they first came over, they settled in Queens, much like a lot of the Haitians were doing back in the late 70s, early 80s. And that's like, that's not really fair, because you're in like basically Little Haiti at that time. If you're in Cambria Heights, Queens, you're surrounded by Haitians. I mean, you miss the motherland, you miss home, you miss the island, but you can catch up because everyone that's there has kind of already like set their flag and found places to get all the ingredients and everything you need. And the bakery started opening up and there were places to go. If they weren't cooking themselves, they can go and get Haitian food. So for them, they were still kind of trapped in that bubble of Haitian identity, and eventually moved into Long Island. I grew up in Hempstead, which is a predominantly Black neighborhood, but it's surrounded by a very rich white suburb. Mm-hmm. So our neighborhood was Haitian. It was Jamaican, very, very Caribbean. It was interesting because I was in private school My parents put me in private school because they were not sending me to public school. My older brothers went to public school and they were like, not the girls. My peers in Catholic school were very white. So it was like I was living two worlds. It was school outside of my neighborhood was one experience. And then within like Hempstead, Uniondale, that was a different experience of just being in a very Caribbean environment. And our neighbors were Caribbean and we would hang out on the street with our neighbors and eat at their homes. And so it wasn't really too difficult trying to kind of latch into those communities because the work had already been done for them, right? And they fell into the communities that they needed to be in to make them feel whole. So it was quite the experience. But yeah, it was all Haitian food all the time at home. Yeah.
Omar, you grew up Muslim and also with activist family and, you know, a lot of Black people, Black Americans, like pork is the first thing to go. And then I know for Haitians, pork is never going. So I'm so curious for both of you in becoming chefs, how did your eating change as a part of your career trajectory?
Well, I mean, mine is easy. I started eating pork. but it took a little while. I mean, I guess by a while, it took me maybe 7 months. But I had been working in kitchens prior to that as a dishwasher and a porter and was still practicing Islam and praying and acknowledging Ramadan. But I couldn't just jump right into pork. So there was this meatloaf that we were serving as a special that had bits of bacon in it. And I ate the meatloaf and I was like, this is the best meatloaf I've ever had. and I'm not even sure if it really had anything to do with the pork, but at that time it did. So I just started eating pork.
Was that the only thing that you started eating? Were there other things you had not had in your diet?
Oh, yeah. I mean, food opened up my entire world. My mind became global just because of food. So like things as simple as like a shallot or fennel or leeks that, like, you know, I go to Whole Foods now and they're just there and I can identify like the quality of them. Before, I was just like, what the hell is a leek? Yeah. You know? So I began to eat more varied vegetables. I began to eat fattier foods. I gained some weight, but then the rigor of the job forced you to lose weight too rapidly. So my diet and like health significantly changed. Oh, alcohol consumption skyrocketed at first because I was curious. I didn't drink a whole lot of beers. I started with drinking a lot of beer and then getting into wine and then pretending to understand the nuance of wine and then actually knowing the nuance of wine.
I mean, for me, being that Haiti was colonized by the French, like a lot of our food ways had a lot of French influences, but it was still in the context of it being like hearty and stewed and very, very rich, and rice was with every meal. And so when I started working in kitchens, I was familiar with certain things, but it was a different approach. And so my relationship kind of expanded, kind of similar to how Omar's does. Like your mind just starts sizzling with like all the possibilities. And it was neat because we get to take all the traditional dishes that we grew up with that we kind of got turned off with because a lot of it doesn't look as, like, for lack of a better term, prim and proper as like the European standards of food. So it was cool having that background and kind of being in restaurants and being in kitchens and seeing like the possibilities of our food and what we could do. And then kind of reverting from that and saying like, F that, we don't need to change the way our food looks. Like it's fine the way it is. So it's been a really interesting trajectory, kind of the relationship that you have with food in the industry, especially with when having a basis of Black foodways as like your foundation.
Omar, your mother raised you largely as a single parent and you learn to cook in order to help out around the house. Can you talk about some of those early dishes that you mastered?
Well, the first like dinner that I learned how to cook was roasted chicken. And I loved my mom's, and still do, love my mom's string beans that she stews in chicken stock with potatoes. And so I asked her to teach me that. She told me how to make that. So those are two things that I learned how to make. And then rice, obviously, but I can't really make rice that well now. I think the first like real thing she told me how to cook for myself was eggs. And to this day, eggs is my favorite food.
How?
Scrambled with cheese.
Sybil, you're the youngest. So I'm wondering, when did you learn to cook, if at all? Because sometimes the baby gets away with it.
Yeah, yeah. No, but we in Haitian households, the girls are taught to cook and clean and do all the things at like age five. So while my brothers were living their best lives as little princes, my sister and I were learning how to cook very early on. And, you know, I used to kind of like, the little feminist in me was like, why? Why aren't they learning how to do this? Why aren't they doing it? But now I understand it was less about being the gender roles, right? And it was more so about my mom just wanting to connect to her girls. And the way she did that was through food.
So with that learning to cook, you know, with your mom and with your sister, what were some of those first recipes?
Actually, the salad russe that we sell in the store, it's the beet potato salad. Mm-hmm. And salad russe translates to like Russian salad. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those kind of neat things about Haiti. We had a lot of migrants come to the island, and a lot of Polish and Russian migrants in the 40s and the 30s. And salad russe has been one of those dishes that have kind of, the tradition is to kind of eat it, especially around Easter time. Mm-hmm. But we really eat it any time. But I distinctly remember understanding and learning how to make it, but really peeling hot potatoes, because my mom wouldn't peel the potatoes before she boiled them. She had to boil them skin on and give them to me to peel, and they had to be peeled hot. So I remember just like my fingers, like as a kid, just trying to like peel it, and it'd be really, really hot, the potatoes and the carrots.
You know what? You should tell her that your mom went to French culinary school in Haiti.
She did, because
that's how they teach people in French culinary school.
Wow.
To cook potatoes and then peel them afterwards.
Oh, hot.
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that. I was always like, this is a rare form of punishment. But I'm doing it. Yeah. I want to eat. Mm-hmm. So that's the one that sticks out for sure.
Omar, I read that your grandfather was a community organizer in South Philly, and that he and your uncles were affiliated with both the Black Panther Party and MOVE. And I was curious, how did growing up in a household rooted in Black radical politics shape your understanding of what was possible for you?
You know, I used to think that that my mom was angry. Anything and everything, my mom's busting through the school door. My son's this, this, and that. Or, I mean, I still remember this one time a cop was, I mean, this shouldn't have happened, but a cop was riding by our house and just turned the light onto our house for no, seemingly no reason whatsoever. My mom comes up, "What the? Why are you shining lights on my house?" And I'm like, "Oh my God!" Like all my friends, like, "Yo, your mom, wow!" You know,
she's drunk,
right? But so it used to be like a little embarrassing for me, because I'm always like, "Mom, you know, we ain't gotta be fighting the power on everything all the time," mm-hmm. right? But it also kind of gave me a true understanding of like racial dynamics. The activism that I saw displayed by my mom was about her own agency, mm-hmm. and more of a nurturing kind of radicalism. I think I took a lot of it for granted. And then also, there's something about, you know, my grandparents' generation where, like, they just don't talk about a lot of stuff,
yeah.
you know? And you ask them, you know, we ain't asking no questions,
right.
you know, but, or
there's
asking enough
to
questions.
Mm.
And I was also taught, you know, part of respecting your elders is to not question, mm-hmm. right? So if they're not offering, there's nothing to ask. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know much about that period. And it's not until now as an adult that I'm like having conversations with not just my uncles, but my aunt, who was a seamstress, mm-hmm. you know, for a long, she's in her 80s now. You know, I want to catch her before she goes. And I want to hear about like that business, the entrepreneurial spirit, the radical spirit, the community spirit has always been in my mother's side of the family.
Sybil, is there an ancestor in your family that has inspired your practice?
One of my great uncles, he actually trained with the Tuskegee Airmen. Growing up, I heard the stories of my Uncle Raymond, and hearing about his commitment to expanding just the positive image of Haiti. And he was very anti-establishment at the time. It was during the Papadoc dictatorship. Mm-hmm. So he did quite a lot against the regime and got himself exiled out of the island. And it's always been just a real fascinating story. But he's definitely been the one living relative that's been, you know, inspiring.
This is just, you know, you can answer it however you'd like. But what is a favorite dish that you like to make right now?
I really enjoy making soup. But like not just like soup.
Really?
Thing.
Seriously, yeah.
Oh my gosh. So we make bouillon in Haiti. It's a soup that is just super hearty and has like all these provisions, all these root vegetables, and typically you have like smoked or salt cured meat. Lately I've been putting crab in it and it's delicious. And it's supposed to take all day. But I found a little hack where it takes only like maybe like 2 hours to make. Mm-hmm. But it's just very delicious and it's just fulfilling. And I think that's like what I've enjoyed making lately.
Well, we recently had a baby. Mm-hmm. We have two babies, mm-hmm. under two.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Thank you. But we also birthed another baby called Honeysuckle Provisions almost at the exact same time.
So three under three, technically, is what we had.
But because of that, I work around the clock. So something that's very quick for me to make when I actually do cook for myself, which is at this point pretty rare, is just heating up broth, like chicken broth or beef broth. And I can take soft greens and like canned sardines and just like condiments and just put it in a bowl and pour that boiling hot broth directly over top of it. And it's like a
ramen,
almost like a ramen. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's the most satisfying thing for me to eat because it still tastes like a home cooked thing. And it only takes like 5 minutes. And it's a reprieve from eating the midnight o'clock fried food that I tend to eat because I just don't know what else to do. And it's no fuss. You know?
Yeah. I think maybe because of watching chefs as part of our popular culture, you know, over the last decade, or just even like, I think living in Philly has made me really conscious of food in a way, because we're not acknowledged for the food scene. And I think it's like incredible and innovative. And it's like, you can have amazing meals from dives to fine dining. But all of that to say, like, I've just personally become like really aware of all these things. And something I had never considered was what chefs eat, and like learning the chefs hate brunch, and like, you know, just sort of thinking about all these things. And so, yeah, I just love to know, like, what is it that you cook? Because I've really come to love restaurants that are like industry restaurants. Mm-hmm. There's a cafe in LA called All Time. That food is amazing and it's so simple.
I mean, something that I wish that would change here in Philly, as great as the food scene is for restaurants, for like sit-down restaurants, it's great. But living in New York, it was very, very easy to pick up my phone and order something that wouldn't make me feel terrible. And that's actually very challenging here in Philly.
True.
If you're ordering online to be delivered to your home,
it's not Sweetgreen. You're out of
No, work. It's not. And if you find it, it's going to cost you almost $200 to get it delivered. You know, when you include delivery, and that's not even an exaggeration. We've spent $150, $180 just trying to order food that won't make us feel like shit. And that's something that we're trying to change through our stores to be able to do that and have it be more affordable. But that's just one. You know, we want more places to be like that because I don't want to eat this food all the time. It's great.
Yeah.
Love salad roof.
It's like, literally, we got food at home, but like times 20. Like, and it's like, okay, let's try something else.
Who has been a mentor to you in the industry?
I mean, specifically here in Philly, we have a great relationship with Ellen Yin, who owns High Street Hospitality, Brandon McCrill, who owns Walnut Street Cafe.
Ben Bynum,
Ben Bynum from South. I'd be remiss to not mention Craig Samuel from Brooklyn, who owns Peaches.
BJ Dennis has been a very good, big cultural mentor. Stefan Duran is a chef from Haiti who's been really influential in my career. He brought me to Haiti to cook for my first time ever, which was pretty life-changing.
Sybil, you co-founded Earthseed Provisions, which is a culinary studio and food lab, and the name originates from Octavia Butler's Parable of the Sower. And I'm curious, what resonated in that text for you to name your project after?
Yeah, it was actually my very, very best friend and partner in Earthseed. Her name is Alice Grandois. She actually is a maker, a phenomenal maker. A friend of hers started D Magazine, which is a really cool magazine about space and community organizing and how we can redesign our communities to like better suit society. From very early on, we'd always had this kind of shared connection in regards to community and placemaking and just making a space for ourselves and having agency in a lot of the things that we were doing. She's also Haitian American, so we had a lot of similarities in how we grew up, also from Long Island. And so we were really always trying to like figure out how do we kind of call this studio and this like home base of where we can like make all the things we want to make, like what resonates with that. And it was really thinking about the future of what we wanted to do. It wasn't the now when we were in it. We were planting all these seeds and doing all these root works to kind of establish ourselves in the now way back when, 15 years ago. And that's evident in Honeysuckle. That's evident in the work she's doing with Deem. And so Octavia Butler just made sense. And thinking about the Earthseed series and thinking about just Black futures and community.
Omar, you decided to abandon your life in New York after attempting to have like a conventional path to chefdom. And then you came back to Philly in 2017 and started from scratch. And I was curious, what was your aha moment or breaking point that inspired this shift? You know, did you have like a bear style breakdown, like sort of what, you know?
No. I mean, I actually came back to Philly in 2020.
It
was in 2017 that I actually managing kitchens. And I was working at this place. It was called Once Upon a Tart in Soho. It had like a 30-year history in that neighborhood, but I was working under a chef, actually a married couple. It's an all-day brunch place that did dinner and sold pastries. Not dissimilar from what we're doing, minus the grocery aspect. But I was being stifled in that position. I'd been denied a couple of other like head chef and executive roles in other places. And I'd never experienced that kind of denial as a line cook. Like anyone wants a line cook. But when you start like wanting positions where power is an issue, people look at you differently. And I received emails that said things like, oh, you don't look like the kind of person we want to run this place. But like there were several other things that took place there where I just felt like very, like pretty marginalized in my creativity. You know, they had no problem with me like spreadsheeting and telling people what to do and hiring and firing. But when it came to idea making, which is like my true passion and, you know, creativity is no. So the one good thing, well, one of the good things, it wasn't a totally bad experience, but one of the good things that happened at Once Upon a Tart is that the owner at the time ran during Women's History Month a pie a day to represent a woman who inspired her. Right. And I was like, in my head, if I wanted to do that for Black History Month or for any purpose whatsoever, where I was inspired by a Black person every day in food, would I even be able to get to day 10? Like seriously, would I be able to get to day 10? And at that time, the answer was no. So I went to the Schomburg in Harlem and just asked for every book they had on Black food, assuming that they had some, because I didn't even know that books existed on Black food. I was looking for historical documents that cataloged our experience as human beings through food. And one of the first books that I came upon was Tony Tipton Martin's The Jemima Code, which is an amazing academic catalog of not just Black food ways, but there's branding there, for better or for worse, obviously, right? Because it does go back to, you know, there are old recipes and old cookbooks, but there's some, you know, blackface and stuff involved in the project. But it just taught me and it reframed my thinking. And I stopped thinking about slaves and I started thinking about people. I stopped thinking about slave diets and slave foods and all, and then it just became food. And honestly, it was that moment that I always felt a little guilty eating pork, but like when I started learning about Black humanity through food, I didn't feel guilty because I felt like it was mine. So like that was the real shift. And the further I went into that, the more I felt like the more confident I felt in my ability to show up and demand what I wanted from this industry.
You've talked about moving away from making pretty plates to beautiful ones. And I'd love if you could explain this difference. Like, how do you define beautiful food?
So the word pretty etymologically goes back to Latin, and I can't remember what the original word was, but it means to lie or to deceive. And whenever you think about things that are classified or categorized as pretty, it is almost always superficial. You know, it's like it's a stage. You know, it's something that's been staged. It's something that we all can kind of like ooh and ah over, but beauty is about depth. And I don't really think that there's a way to discuss or describe beauty, like, not in English, at least, you know, it's hard. I feel like English is one of those languages where like all the words are so exacting that it doesn't allow room for your mind to imagine its volume. Right. And beauty is about that, you know, that expansiveness. It's the cloud that we all live in. That is the collective experience of life. And you can find that in several different things, you know.
I've heard you say that before. And I, every time I hear you say it, I have to like remind myself, like next time he calls me pretty.
He's throwing hands.
Sometimes people want to hear that. There's value in pretty, right? But I do think that pretty has become the new beauty. That's what I think.
No,
I cleaned it up.
Yeah, no. I'm gonna start making a mental note and that we call something pretty.
Sybil, do you share this philosophy?
I think to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. I have, in terms of food specifically, have challenged myself in the way that I perceive food visually over the years, specifically our food ways, right? And the words that we use to talk about them when they're positioned differently than the traditional way. And a lot of folks like to say elevate a lot. And it really grinds my gears, because to say that you're elevating something means that it wasn't shit to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that's harmful. And that's not, if that was the case, then generations wouldn't be fulfilled off this stuff, right? Communities, families wouldn't be fulfilled off this stuff. So pretty and beautiful are wonderful ways to describe art. Mm-hmm. And food is art to a certain extent. Or food is art, period, actually, not to a certain extent. It's art, period. But I don't know that I think about it in that way anymore. I think, mm-hmm. Especially after having given birth, I think about food and I think about dishes as just a sustainability and nurturing and what that means for your body and how we can share that with our kin. I don't think about it from that perspective so much anymore.
How did y'all meet?
But I've been the one telling it, and so you can tell it.
So we met March 5th, 2020. I remember the date.
Mm. Tell them what kind of mood it was.
Height of the pandemic.
Right before the end. I mean, it was creeping in. People were already talking about COVID.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was an orange moon.
Thank you.
Orange moon. We were both invited to cook for Charleston Wine and Food. We were both called upon by BJ Dennis, our friend and mentor.
And Cupid, apparently.
And apparently Cupid. Yep. Yeah, we were doing the festival together. And over the course of a weekend, we spent a lot of time with one another. I like to think that we went on like 10 hyper intimate dates all in one weekend, mm-hmm. and doing different things. We went to brunch. We went to go visit the homes that my family still owned, mm-hmm. in South Carolina, and the church that they used to go to.
We karaoke'd.
We karaoke'd.
We sang. We rapped. And that's how you know marriage. That's when we knew. Yeah.
Yeah. So she left first, and I was there for a whole day after she left. Like, I think that this is it. She's the one, and I love her. Mm-hmm. And yeah.
Since this whirlwind, not only romance, but, you know, life shifts, what continues to surprise you about each other? Like this week, maybe, or recently?
You know what? Sybil's energy. Mm. Seriously. I mean, she, like, as we mentioned, we had two babies, Jupiter and Apollo. Apollo's the younger one. Jupiter's the older one. Jupiter was a night sleeper. He was great. He was like, oh, it's time for bed, let's do this. Apollo's like, it's time for bed, I'm good. I'm gonna sit up, I'm gonna cry. And so Sybil has had to sit in a rocking chair for the past 5 months and pretty much hold him so that he can sleep. And then when she comes to the store, she's like, hey, everybody, and all excited. And I'm like, how do you have not just the energy, mm-hmm. but the joy? Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like the happiness, because I mean, I'm also not sleeping in a very different way, and I am not that person. Mm-hmm. And as much as I want to be, and I mean, I used to try to be, but now I'm just like, y'all getting this Omar today. Yeah, that surprises me. And it actually makes me like a little envious, mm. that I can't carry that. But it also like makes me love you a lot, mm. because yeah, I think it's beautiful.
I don't know where it comes from. I don't know. I can't say it's just coffee. I think it's just, certainly inspired by the sacrifices you've had to make while our family's been growing alongside this business. And there was a period in time when I was on maternity leave that Omar was working overnights because we needed bread. We bake our own bread, and mm-hmm. we only had one baker, and it was an overnight process and multiple days working overnight and well into the day, actually working those shifts. And it was just very inspiring how he continued to keep doing it. And he kept doing it. And he kept doing it. Kept doing it. And I was like, man, if he could do that for a month straight, I could wake up and make sure that everyone knows that the energy is still there in the store. Mm-hmm. And that we, it might be rough times sometimes, our attitudes, our moods might not be there, but this is still a safe space where people first and foremost should experience joy because it's food. And so I think that's the motivation.
What gave you all the courage to open a food-based business in the pandemic?
Insanity.
Yeah, I mean,
yeah.
I don't know if it was like a thought about. This is a downhill thing, you know. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. between both of us, we have like 25 years experience in cooking. And mm-hmm. I mean, speaking for myself, like I'm only able to do all the other things that I do because I do this, because I put that apron on, mm-hmm. you know. And the logical next step for myself was, I mean, I've always been entrepreneurial. Like, I sold t-shirts and I did this and I did that. Mm-hmm. So the only logical next step was to own a business. And despite what was going on in the world, or, you know, naivete or just ignorance, because half the time I can't even watch the news, mm-hmm. it was honeysuckle or nothing, you know? Yeah.
Also, I think we were also very much fueled by the desire or the need to nourish this one community, mm-hmm. our community. We live two blocks from the store now. And that motivation, when you have kids and you think about their futures and you think about the food ecosystem that we live in, that we kind of came up in professionally, we think about just how toxic and trash it is, right? And it's, our kids are going to have to exist in this food system. And so why not do our part?
Where does the name honeysuckle come from?
So growing up in Germantown, there was a honeysuckle bush that grew along the side of my house. But for me to get back to a place of, you know, remembering family and childhood innocence and creativity, remembering home was it. And that smell and taste of honeysuckle was mm-hmm. was always that.
What are your hopes for the future of honeysuckle? And what are you hoping its impact is on the industry?
So if you would ask us this question, like maybe even a year ago, a few months ago, before we actually opened, we would have been like, we want honeysuckle everywhere. Mm. But I think now it doesn't have to be honeysuckle as it exists now. I think what I know we want is that we want to establish West Philadelphia as a place where people can go and eat really good food. Mm. And
West Philly needs that.
West Philly needs that. West Philly deserves that. Yeah. Like the people that exist in West Philly deserve to have to not go downtown or go to South or go anywhere else to get food mm-hmm. or to celebrate moments. And so I know for us in this moment immediately, we want to establish a few concepts in West Philly, and we want to just create safe spaces for all types of people to enjoy the food that we kind of grew up with, mm-hmm. the food that we enjoy making. And then from there, once we do that, then maybe honeysuckle and some like transportation hubs, you know. It's important for honeysuckle to exist really close to a farm, mm-hmm. right? So we can kind of continue to do the work that we're doing. And I think if that's the case, then more up and down the East Coast could be really dope, because then we can connect all these farms and create this supply chain and mm-hmm. this circuit of food running up and down the East Coast, highlighting, celebrating Black farmers, supporting Black farmers, mm-hmm. and supporting the Black-owned businesses, restaurants, and food services that the Black farmers can kind of sell to. And I think that's like immediate, like 10 years, 5-10 years, that's what we want.
What is the most realistic portrayal of a kitchen and a chef's life that you've seen in film or television?
The Bear.
Definitely The Bear, and then Ratatouille too.
The actual food was real.
The food was real. And also like the pressure of like a critic coming in and—
Oh, well, there's that.
Yeah.
But The Rat in the Hat?
Right.
Okay.
The Bear felt real.
Definitely.
Which is why I wanted to ask you.
Yeah,
all,
no,
I was like, this feels like a documentary. Like, what is
I had to take a break. It gave me anxiety. It reminded me of all the things I hated about the industry.
Are there any cooking shows or documentaries that have shifted how you viewed or experienced food? Like, I think about like Water for Chocolate changed my relationship to food in some ways. And I also really enjoyed High on the Hog, and I feel like it made me think about some things. But for either of you, you know, so Anthony Bourdain, like what are...
Anthony Bourdain is always going to be inspirational for us. I mean, he just went to the places that no one was really trying to go to, right? Mm-hmm. At a time where when I was working on the line, like when he went to Haiti, I was just like, what? Like the episode was what it was, but like he still went there. And And he did that with a lot of other places. And the cooks that I worked with from Central America or South America were always so hyped when he would go to their one of their countries. And it gave us special kind of like camaraderie in the kitchen for us at the mm-hmm. time. I thought it was pretty dope. Ina Garten is super fly, and I aspire to be that great when I retire. She's so fly.
You both have creative interests beyond medium of food, and I'm curious if there's any desire to expand on those other interests professionally or even on the side. As you make space for less work, are you going to write more? You're both writers.
Well, I'm actually actively pursuing my artistic endeavors at the same time. Mm-hmm. It's actually driving me crazy. but I am quietly writing a book right now. And also...
not so quietly. You could publicly say it. Say it with your chest. You're writing a book.
I'm also not the... I hate being the person that says, I'm doing this thing.
And you should ask the question.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just not really a flashy guy, mm-hmm. you know? And I feel like that's the new flash, right? Like people are on Instagram and all this kind of stuff and publicizing the things that I'm going to do this or mm-hmm. I'm doing that. And like, they're not even really doing it. And maybe it's the Philly in me. Like, I think that's where,
definitely
like, that's definitely the Philly in me. Like,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
real stuff on me. But the book is real. My actual like goal for peace and joy in career is to be a professional working artist by 50.
Okay.
That's what I want to do.
How old are you now?
36.
How about you, Sybil?
I would like to write more. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would definitely like to write more. I wrote one children's book, but I don't know, with two kids running around, I'm just always thinking about the messes that they can get into, that they do get into, and how that would translate in a book form for other children to read and engage with. So that's always something that I'm always thinking about and would like to do when things settle down. We are trying to like figure out ways to visually tell our story, you mm-hmm. know, whether it be a documentary form or a cooking show or some type of segment, just really go further and take people to the farm mm-hmm. and have them talk to the farmers and to meet our neighbors, and always just thinking about ways to like creatively tell our story.
So I have two final questions, and you can choose which one you want to answer mm-hmm. or both. One is, where do you find inspiration? And for whom do you make food?
I'm going to choose the inspiration. Nature. Like the infinite, you know, the ellipses of life. Even when I'm like hyper stressed and like anxious, I'll notice the moon, flowers, leaves, breath, you know, my children, our nature, you know, that is just the impeccable curiosity that they have is just natural human element. Jupiter likes to... One of my favorite things, I love watching him line up things. He's like very meticulous. He'll count his little colorful balls and just place them and place them and place them. Then it's like, just smashes it. You know, I love that. But then, you know, it's going to sound really cheesy, but like birds chirping. It's beautiful, you know?
Yeah, so I answer the other question, who do I make food for? I mean, literally, obviously I make food for my family and my kids, myself. But in the communal sense, and this is something I've been thinking about more so as I kind of think about just how I want to approach Haitian food in Philadelphia and how I want to engage in this community. I think I make food for not only people with Haitian background, but for folks who straddle two cultures mm-hmm. and they're trying to find their center. Mm-hmm. And it's a little bit of one side, it's a little bit of another side, or it's a little bit of a lot of nothing at all. But I think within that, there's this imagination that can kind of occur that is still rooted in history, that's still rooted in like our foundation, but it is also just very, very fun. Mm-hmm. And I think that's who I make food for. I make food for the person that's still exploring their identity with the influence of everything around them.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much again for agreeing to do this show. I really appreciate it.
Yeah,
good. Thank you.
Thanks for making us feel comfortable.
Yeah.
To keep up with more of Omar Tate and Sybil St. Aude Tate's work, you can follow them on Instagram at honeysuckle_provisions. This season of Many Lumens is brought to you by Open Society Foundations. It is produced by Black Star Projects in partnership with Row Home Productions. The host and executive producer of Many Lumens is me, Mayori Carmel Holmes. This episode was produced by Kayla Lattimore.
Associate producers are Irit Reinheimer and Zoe Greggs. Managing producer is Alex Lewis. Executive editor is John Myers. Justin Berger is our final mix and mastering engineer. Our music supervisor is David Little Dave Adams. Our theme song was composed by Vijay Mohan and remixed by Little Dave. This episode features music by Maleke, Onay, and DJ Applejack. If you've liked what you've heard so far this season, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and let us know what you think of the show. Sending you light, and see you next time.